From Sorrento, Italy, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. World War II left the Dutch Empire in flux. The Queen fled to London, and Japanese occupation cut the country off from its colony Indonesia.
They realized during the war that maybe this was not sustainable. The Netherlands would never really return to the Indies as it had, but they wanted to control the exit process.
I'll talk with Purdue University historian Jennifer Foray about how the country changed in the 20th century. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I discuss what we have learned over the past 2 weeks about issues of migration and immigration in Italy.
Some of our students also pointed out signs telling the migrants and the refugees to go back. Others noticed signs that said, you know, not all refugees are terrorists.
That's all coming up right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Rebecca Cruz, we've been in Italy for the past 2 weeks. You're now back stateside. I'm still here in Italy. We've been here with students, and we've been learning a lot about the issues of migration, immigration in Italy. Your class, in fact, was focused on that issue. So tell us a little bit about what you learned about these issues Italy is facing today.
Well, unfortunately, as many of our listeners may know, this last week was a very bad week on the Mediterranean. As the temperatures get warmer and the Mediterranean gets a little bit calmer, the numbers are going to increase. We had about 1,000 people that probably perished, and about 13,000 that came into Italy. So the crisis that we saw last summer is essentially going to repeat itself, and the numbers are looking higher. But it was very interesting. I think you and I were together a couple of times in Rome where we saw some protest of migrants. Most of them looked to be from Africa, of African descent of some sort, and protesting, asking for better rights. They're being held in centers, and they were wanting Wi-Fi and to be treated better. Some of our students also pointed out signs that were around Rome telling the migrants and the refugees to go back. Others noticed signs that said, you know, not all refugees are terrorists. So we definitely saw things in Rome changing. I also had the opportunity to take my class to go and meet with representatives from the International Organization for Migration. And this was a really interesting meeting that we had. They talked about the migration patterns and how Italy is really expecting the summer to be amongst the worst. They had 150 or so thousand last year and are expecting more this year because the other two routes through Spain and then through Turkey have essentially been cut off. And so Italy remains one of the only routes that's going to be an option for those fleeing. They're seeing more and more people from Eritrea, a lot from West Africa, not so many from Syria. And actually what was so interesting is they said 60 nationalities were coming through. I think we often the media has focused on Syria because of the refugee situation, but a lot of these are migrants coming from all over Africa, and actually the movement of people across Africa that aren't even making it up to the Mediterranean is very, very significant.
Well, obviously, Italy has been for a long time an entry point into Europe. It's a peninsula, so it's surrounded by water on three sides, and there are lots of ways in which you can enter the country. And so Italy has struggled with this issue for many, many, many years. This isn't a new thing, right? And yet at the same time, Italians really seem to be kind of in denial about the immigration issue. They seem to think that it is a migrating point and that these migrants aren't staying in Italy. But I think we've seen just the opposite, even though the European Union requires that migrants register in the land where they first land. This doesn't seem to be happening here in Italy. I mean, what is the story about this?
Well, there still are many that would like to move further north, though, of course, not all of them. But that's easier said than done. One of the other things I think that was so interesting was the IOM and then another group we met with really used the word irregular migration as opposed to illegal migration. And part of this comes from the fact that it was recently decriminalized, so that's part of it, and also because they are wanting to take the stigma out, to kind of depoliticize it to an extent, to really not make these people viewed as criminals or illegal immediately upon entry, but that they are irregular people coming in. This isn't a new issue in Italy, but it really has been on the uptick the last couple of years. And certainly these people from Africa, that has been on the increase as well.
Well, this seems to be exacerbating a number of problems that already exist in Italy. Social services obviously are being stretched to the limit. Italy, of course, is dealing with economic, financial crisis. So how are they going to get their way out of this?
Well, that's a really good question, and they're not quite sure. But as the director of the IOM mentioned to us when we spoke with him, he said future generations are going to look at Italy and see how they respond and are going to judge them. So they need to find a solution. There are a lot of options, a lot of build walls sort of options. As you mentioned, Italians, many of them kind of getting to their nationalist roots here. But the people aren't going to stop, and they're going to have to find ways to help with the social services. Otherwise, we're going to have these people just sitting in detention areas for who knows how long.
All right, Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us as always on Worldviews. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and enjoy the rest of your time.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you might have. We welcome your comments in the Worldviews section of our website, kgou.org. You can also get in touch with us via KGOU's Facebook page or through Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. I tweet at Suzek Verlot. After a short break, I'm joined by Jennifer Foray. She's an historian of European imperial history at Purdue University in Indiana. She studies World War II and the end of the Netherlands colonial era. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. My guest this half hour is Jennifer Foray. She's a professor of modern European history at Purdue University, who focuses on the end of Dutch colonialism during the 20th century. She's the author of the 2014 book, Visions of Empire in the Nazi-Occupied Netherlands. Jennifer Foray, welcome to Worldviews.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Well, Jennifer, you've done some really interesting work, particularly on the Netherlands and their colonial experience, how you examine their experience with war and occupation, imperialism, and decolonization. And I really want to kind of focus on that. Obviously, the Netherlands was a major mm-hmm. colonial power mm-hmm. at one point in time. They had colonies all over the world. And yet there was something about their experience with the Second World War mm-hmm. and resistance movements during that time mm-hmm. that caused them to question their colonial presence. Mm-hmm. Tell us, just start there and tell us a little bit about kind of, first of all, you know, kind of how you got involved in that kind of research.
Yeah.
But then, you know, how it is that the Dutch began to question their colonial presence Great. Around the world.
I first became involved in this topic, admittedly, very, very many years ago through the Diary of Anne Frank. And that's actually what started me looking at Holland as seen during World War II. So from there, I really moved in different directions with that. I had a Fulbright to the Netherlands after I graduated undergraduate, where I investigated university student resistance during the German occupation. The Netherlands was occupied by the Germans from May 1940 until May 1945. And then from 1942 to 1945, their most important colony, the Dutch East Indies, today's Indonesia, was occupied by the Japanese. And so my work has really gone in this direction of looking at, using the Dutch as an example, how it is that a society subjected to occupation, foreign rule, considers itself and wishes to proceed as an imperial power. And so what we find in the Netherlands and what I've examined is these different cross currents of ideas that happened during the war, many led by underground resistors, writers, journalists, who, when not writing, when not resisting the German occupiers, were trying to plan a different and potentially better future for the country and for the empire. And so what I argue is that the war forced a rethinking on the Dutch part, but it really also created these circumstances where they couldn't avoid it any longer. Of the other European empires, only the Netherlands was occupied by the Germans or any foreign power at home in its metropolitan center, and occupied its most important colony, occupied abroad as well. So British India, obviously, was not occupied. Indonesia was. And this really cut off parts of the empire. The Queen went to London during the war and ruled the country in absentia from London, technically ruling over the colonies as well. So there's a lot in flux during this period, and that's really what I've focused on. So you see some voices that are very progressive, progressive and calling for a rethinking of colonial relationships and so on. And then you see voices that are saying, well, this was a time of great misfortune for our country. We can't afford to let loose of our most important colony right now.
It's so interesting because obviously the Netherlands, having been a really important colonial power, as I mentioned, and as you discussed, then shifts really to become the center of post-World War II peace and tolerance in some ways, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you create the Hague.
You have so many
institutions that are then settle in the Netherlands. They're known kind of as the seat of international law.
Yeah.
So they, but your reference to everyday people, really, journalists and just people that are contemplating these things, they're the ones that actually brought this about. I mean, this was kind of a contemplation on their part that then brought about a whole different Holland.
That's a really great point, because I think in some ways the 20th century Netherlands and Dutch society is fairly conservative, and yet that not so much now, but throughout the 20th century. And yet that functions alongside this idea of tolerance and liberal ideas and kind of a place for everyone to have their say. And that existed alongside the colonies. There were always colonial reform movements for a more just, progressive form of colonialism. So that most certainly did exist. What you see during decolonization and even during the last phases of imperialism in the Netherlands, and that will affect the post-war period, is that the Dutch really did wish to control the process, which is no different than many other imperial powers, too. They wish to control the process of decolonization. They realized during the war that maybe this was not sustainable. The Netherlands would never really return to the Indies as it had, but they wanted to control the exit process. So, and I think that does function alongside Dutch ideas of legality and norms. Much of decolonization in the Netherlands was done by constitutional reform. So there is ways in which this is, yes, about a particular Dutch identity, as well as more mainstream political movements. And then also in the Netherlands, you see the influence, this is some of the work that I'm doing now, you see the influence of Indonesian politicians in the Netherlands who are really part of Dutch political parties and are trying to steer them perhaps in a very different direction, mostly on the political left.
I'm talking with Purdue University historian Jennifer Foray about the end of the Netherlands colonial era during and after World War II. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Let's get back to my conversation with Purdue University historian Jennifer Foray. When we left off, she argued that modern Dutch society is shaped by the relationships that were both strengthened and strained during mid-20th century decolonization.
So would you consider the Netherlands then to have been a leader in the decolonization effort?
Absolutely not.
Because it seems like they weren't necessarily on the forefront of it. And how well would you say their particular colonies have done in the post-colonial period? Because it is interesting to see how they're very different, the colonies themselves, depending on who their colonizer was, how well they've done in developing, modernizing, and becoming, you know, a good, solid countries and governments.
Absolutely. And I think that I'm personally a little bit loath to get into some of the comparisons, because I've had both people say to me, and then also other scholars who argue and say things like, well, compared to the British or compared to the French, the Dutch weren't that bad, or the Dutch war in Indonesia in 45 to 47 didn't produce as many victims as another war. So I think it's really hard to say that there's any one model. I think what the Netherlands shows and the Dutch case show is that this is messy, this is complicated, this is a process, and it is most certainly decolonization is an ongoing set of relationships. And so you have very much Dutch-Indonesian relations today, colored by a very connected past. That some of that also has to do with who's ruling Indonesia, Sukarno and then Suharto, and that shaped Dutch relations. Dutch relations with Suriname and Curaçao obviously have been set in motion by the post-war period and their relationships with the Netherlands as well. But I think as a whole, the Netherlands today reflects that history fairly well. It's obviously a very, very diverse society, but that can also paper over some of the problems of decolonization and some of the challenges that I think Dutch society and other colonized societies obviously have had to contend with.
Well, that's what I was going to ask next. Yeah. Anyone who's been to the Netherlands knows, and particularly Amsterdam. It's an extremely diverse community, and so interestingly and excitingly so. You know, it's a very vibrant place. I mean, I'd been going there for many years. You know, in and out for various reasons, and when traveling to Europe, and it's it is just incredible the numbers of different kinds of people and languages that you hear. But like other countries in Europe, former colonial powers, you do tend to see a stretching of that. You know, I mean, this stretching and meaning they're stretching the limits, perhaps, of their tolerance for diversity, because you're starting to see a bit of backlash in other parts. And actually, I thought the Netherlands might be, given its kind of seat as an international player, you know, international law, that you would not necessarily see it there, but you have.
Yeah, I mean, and one thing that I've noticed in the last, because I've been working in Holland for probably about 20 years now, since I first had that Fulbright as a graduating senior from undergrad. And one thing that I've noticed is that the in and out groups change frequently. So when I first began working there in the late 90s, the immigrant group that was seen as not really acculturated, there were the Indonesians, the Indo-Europeans as well, the Moluccans, other group of Indonesian emigrants and those who had come from the colonies in the 60s and 70s. And then there were the Turks. And then that shifted in the last 20 years. So now the Indonesians and the Surinamese and the Curacaoans are seen as, well, they're ours because they were from our colony. They're very different kinds of immigrants than the Moroccans or the Algerians. The Turks have now become kind of old hat to them. They're one of their accepted minority groups since they've been there so long. But there is definitely a sense of, well, Indonesians are our people. And they've always been our immigrant group. The Curacaoans, the Surinamese, that's our empire, so that makes sense. That's very different than other groups of immigrants, asylum seekers, and so on. So it does definitely come into the discussion in ways that I think we couldn't have anticipated 20 years ago. And of course, much has happened in Holland since then as well. Populist politics on the right, Pim Fortuyn, especially in the early 2000s, Geert Wilders, and a very far-right populism as well. So there's a lot of motion and activity.
Well, and I have to mention the very high-profile murder of
Theo van Gogh. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And in response to his film about the Islamic world, and particularly its treatment of women. So, I mean,
here's the Ali.
It seems to be this is a growing concern in the Netherlands as well.
It's a growing concern, but at the same time, I mean, I've seen some of it just more anecdotally in response to the Brussels attacks and the Paris attacks. I don't think any Amsterdammer would be very surprised if it happens there. On the other hand, there is a sense of there are Muslim communities established in Amsterdam, especially that have been there for a very long period of time. And even those who are not there for a very long period of time are integrated into or not integrated into various parts of Dutch society. So it's never black or white. And in 2004, 2005, not that long after the murder of Theo van Gogh, I saw personally many cooperative grassroots organizations of just people speaking to one another. People on talk shows wearing hijabs that you would never see before. In some ways, yes, it is a very conservative bourgeois culture, and anything that's a little bit different, women of any race can be seen as in the minority. So there's much more of a conversation now about this and what's acceptable, what are Dutch values, what does this mean, how do we make people Dutch citizens if that's what they want, is it language solely? And at the same time, the population of Amsterdam has become far more global and English-speaking as well at the same time. So it's very much an international city.
It is an international city.
It's no longer, I think, strictly a colonial metropole. It's really this hodgepodge of international trade and so on. So,
well, shifting gears just one second, because obviously we've been talking about your work on responses to war and trauma in the Netherlands. But in addition to that, you've done some work on memorialization and commemoration after war. Tell us a little bit about that and how, whether it's focused particularly on the Netherlands or other parts
of the world
experiencing that.
Yeah, I think it's very much linked to the way that part of what happens in the Netherlands and why it's unique, and this is what I'm working on right now, is the fact that decolonization and this loss of the East Indies and the creation of and the acceptance of Indonesia happened so soon after World War II. So at some point there is very much a twinning and overlapping of certain narratives. And one thing that I'm examining now is these resistance ideas of good versus bad, heroism, sacrifice, and how that tends to overshadow gradations and the gray that's in between, and then how that also shapes the way Dutch political actors view what's happening in Indonesia. So since they view Dutch collaborators as the worst of the worst, true traitors, and so on, in the Netherlands, the idea was that those who cooperated with the Japanese in Indonesia during the war were just as bad, and so they should be punished as well. So at some point, these narratives overlap, and sometimes they play out in memorials, they play out in ceremonies. One thing that you see in the Netherlands after the war is creation of various civic organizations and memorial societies, which to date, many of them are very, very active. So they will be organizations for the women of Ravensbrück concentration camp, the Dutch Auschwitz Comité, various veterans organizations, veterans who fought in the Indies after the war.
Well, even the Anne Frank House itself in Amsterdam is some sort of memorialization and commemoration.
Oh, absolutely.
The biggest and the most iconic
It's the most iconic one. And I think what I found fascinating about that memorial practice, too, is the levels of commemoration and ideas that keep being added on to that. So I'm living right now in Amsterdam, a few blocks away from the house, and I've noticed in the mornings, the summer used to be the busiest time. Obviously, you would have lines around the corner. It's very well managed. You can get advance tickets. And I've noticed that consistently now in wintertime as well. It becomes this pilgrimage. And that's also not even just about the war, but because of The Fault in Our Stars, which was set in Amsterdam. So that's another layer on top of that.
Very interesting. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much. We've just scratched the surface, I know, on this very important topic. But thank you for being with us today.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Jennifer Foray. She teaches history at Purdue University in Indiana and is the author of the 2014 book, Visions of Empire in the Nazi-Occupied Netherlands. You can find more information and download this episode at kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews with the support of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Brian Hardzinski edits the interviews and writes our digital content, and Sam Dupre helps put the show together. Miranda Wilson prepares our research. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolotte.